You are listening to the In Perspective weekly podcast with Bob Branco and Peter O'Toole.
Hi, everybody. Welcome once again to In Perspective. My name is Bob Branco, and this is episode 311, dated Friday, June 2nd, 2023. Let me first introduce our guest, our co-host, our friend, our colleague, Peter O'Toole.
Good afternoon from sunny and humid Columbia, Missouri. Summer has arrived, much to my annoyance.
It's arrived here. Not much to my annoyance, because we haven't had much warm weather this spring in the Northeast. But it will be short-lived, according to reliable weather forecasts. So we'll see what happens. Before we continue, I would like to thank those people who make it possible for In Perspective to be aired and made to the general public. We start out with our media outlets. Thank you for airing us when you do. Tom and Lynn from Rosie's Place, thank you very much for posting In Perspective on greeting door number 15. I also want to thank Raymond Gay, who is our editor and producer, for doing what he does so well, as well as Jacqueline Sylvia from JS Web Solutions, who archives our shows on my website. Just go to www.brancoevents.com, arrow down until you get to In Perspective Podcasts, click on them, and you will see our archived programs from latest to earliest.
Merci, Jackie.
Disability discrimination is very, very common, more common than it should be. But that's life as we know it, and a lot of times people don't know what to do about it. Other people have figured out ways to combat it. And on our program today is somebody who decided to write about it. Her name is Sherry Gomes. Sherry, you wrote a book called Haven, and that book is about recovery, redemption, revenge, and disability discrimination. Sounds like a very exciting book on a topic that is well thought of and well discussed here in the community, I'm afraid. Sherry, welcome to In Perspective. Thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm really looking forward to it.
And Sherry, go ahead, Peter.
Sherry, before we talk about the book, let's talk a little about you. What were you doing before you began writing?
Well, if you want to be technical, I was a little baby before I started writing, but I've really been a kind of compulsive writer all my life. Journals, poetry, when I was a love-struck teenager, that kind of thing. Lots of stories, fan fiction, everything. But the jobs, the actual jobs I've had, I worked for Nordstrom, if you're familiar with that company.
I am.
I worked at the Seattle Lighthouse for the Blind as an assistant to the director of PR. I worked at Verizon Wireless, which I really hated, and I worked at Guide Dogs for the Blind, and then Vispero in tech support.
I'm curious, why did you hate the job with Verizon?
I was in my 40s, and the job was really geared for young people, the pace, the demands, and they had a program called the Inter-Day Management Program. I can't believe I still remember that. And basically they monitored everything, which you expect when you're doing a phone job, you're monitored. But things like if I was out with my guide dog relieving her more than, 5 minutes, they'd send supervisors out to look for me and things like that. I just didn't like the atmosphere.
Good a lot
company,
of pressure.
Just not a good, yeah, a lot of pressure and big room with tons and tons and tons of people. So lots of noise, hard to get around. I just didn't like it. Bad schedules. I thought I got rid of weekends and nights when I left Nordstrom. So didn't like the schedule, but it was a
Peter,
good company.
I know Peter has heard of Nordstrom, but I haven't. What is Nordstrom? What do they do?
Nordstrom is a very, well, it used to be, it's changed some, but it used to be a very upscale department store type place.
Okay.
It was originally from the Seattle area and spread around the country. It was known for its high level of customer service.
And I assume you live in the Seattle area?
No, I lived in San Diego when that happened, when I worked at Nordstrom at a store there. They were known for hiring people with disabilities before the ADA, you know, kind of made it a law. So they were a really good company, probably the best job I ever had.
So, Sherry, your book, well, let's, before I ask that question, talk about what prompted you to write this book in the first place, Haven.
Well, I wanted to write a novel. I'd been wanting that since I was 9 or 10 years old. And one day that I read an article, I'd read them off and on over the years, but I read an article about a blind couple that had custody taken away from them in the hospital right after the baby was born by Child Protective Services. And I was angry and distraught over that. All my life, I'd wanted to have kids. I never did have them, but I'd always wanted them. And the idea that somebody could just walk in with this misguided, horrendous idea that disabled people can't safely raise children. I was so horrified. I thought, I just have to write about this.
How far did the case go?
I never heard the outcome. I knew that it was being fought, but I never heard the outcome of it.
So I don't want to give away too much of the plot of the book, but the case starts with the heroine of the story, a woman losing custody of the child in a divorce hearing. Is that a fair assessment?
That's right.
Okay. And, what gave you the courage to sort of write about what might happen afterwards? You know, in other words, now you have this woman who's lost everything. Basically, she's lost her marriage. Well, she asked for a divorce and she's lost her child. The book talks about what happened next. What experiences, what prompted you to write this book about what happened afterwards?
Well, I wanted to write romance novels, and it's categorized as a romance, so I think it's a lot more than that. But also, I've had a number of circumstances in my life, not this one, but circumstances where I've had to start over. And I wanted to show Elizabeth, that's the main character, I wanted to show her journey from this devastating scene at the beginning of the novel to her triumph, learning to trust again, starting life over, finding new friends, finding new love, and working to try to get her child back.
And the book starts with, well, once the prologue is written, it starts with her living in a sort of a small town in Colorado. Have you had experience living in small towns, or, you know, sort of more laid back lifestyle?
Yes, I did live in Colorado at the time that I wrote it. I kind of based, the town is Haven Valley. I based it on, Estes Park in Colorado, only in my mind it's smaller than Estes Park. Estes Park is a small touristy town with stores and shops and restaurants up and down all the main streets, and everybody just walks all over and goes in all these stores, and they're cute kitchen gadgets and homemade leather items and a Christmas shop and a candy shop and an ice cream shop and art, all that kind of thing. So I based Haven Valley on that. But I also now live in a very small town in California that's smaller than the small town I lived in Colorado. And I like the feel of Estes Park. I love the feel of the town I live in now. And I wanted to reflect that when I invented Haven Valley.
So the book, of course, is called Haven. And what's the significance of Haven for you? You know, why that particular title?
I moved to Colorado to live near good friends of mine after some very traumatic things happened to me out here in California, which is where I'm from, California originally. And my friend said, you know, move out here near us. You'll be near people that love you and we'll help you get your life started again. So Colorado became my haven. And that's another aspect of the book haven, was that I wanted to pay homage to a place where I found peace and emotional healing. I found a haven there.
And talk about the importance of religion in the book, Christianity specifically.
Yeah, I did not want it to be a Christian fiction book because I didn't want people who don't read that kind of thing to avoid it because I think it appeals to everybody. But when the character of Michael, the love interest male lead, as I like to call him, came into my mind, he came as a pastor of a small church in this small town. And I tried to change him. I tried to make him like a youth leader in some sort of thing like the girls and boys clubs or something like that. I tried so many things to make him different, but he would be a pastor and nothing else. So there are scenes that take place in the church. There's a number of them because that's Michael's life and that's where his friends are. But it's also not, there's not, say, a conversion scene or that kind of aspect of a Christian fiction book.
Yeah, that was, I'm really curious about two things you just said. The first thing has to do with Michael came into your mind as a Christian pastor. I know it's sort of hard to sort of think about subconscious stuff, but how do you think that happened? I mean, you didn't want to write about, you know, the whole Christianity thing, and yet Michael came in as a pastor and into your subconscious. Can you, how do you think that happened, or what prompted that?
It's hard to explain because some writers have this, we talk about the characters talk to us. Come into our minds.
I do understand that, but I'm sort of curious if you have other things that sort of sprung from that or something.
I don't know if it's a, you know, like some sort of subconscious thing relating to some pastor I knew a long time ago. All I can say is Michael came into my mind one day and I mean, he just was there. I didn't sit down later. I did, but initially I didn't sit down and think about, okay, my main male lead, what do I want his job to be? What do I want this and that? He just came. He was Michael Kelly. He was a pastor. He had red hair and blue eyes, and that's just who he was. Later, I sat down with some Word documents and wrote out my main characters and asked questions like, what do they do? What do they like to eat? Do they watch TV? Do they like music? What kind of activities do they like to do? But originally, Michael just came into my head that way.
And the other question that sort of came to mind as you wrote about that is when I read the book, I was expecting at some point, it doesn't make the book bad that it didn't happen, but I was expecting to happen that the heroine would have some kind of conversion experience, would come to some, if not born again experience, that she'd become a Christian of some description. And that never really happens in the book. Was that a deliberate decision on your part?
It was very deliberate. There is one scene when they're taking a hike and Michael says something, I can't remember the exact quote now, about, you know, I know you don't believe in God. And Elizabeth said, you know, I've got, you know, this land is beautiful. I've got you and his son, Ethan. How could I not believe in God? And that's all.
Yeah. And I thought that was fascinating. It's also found it fascinating. And this is another way the book steers from the usual Christian fiction, thing is that Michael marries an unbeliever.
Yeah.
I don't want to give away too much of this book, but you know, and was that a deliberate choice from you as well? That's what was going to happen?
I left it up to the mind of the reader. The reader can assume he married an unbeliever, or they can assume from that one line, how could I not believe in God, that she becomes a believer. But I wanted the reader to take the story ahead in their own minds. In my opinion, by the end of the book, I think Elizabeth is a believer. But you can take that any way, however you interpret the book.
And what I would say about it is she's closer to being a believer than she was at the beginning of the book.
Yes.
I think that's.
At the beginning of the book, she's hurt. She's angry. You know, why would she be a believer?
Sure.
She was in a lot of pain. Sure. And I really wanted to keep the religiosity down. And I wanted even the church scenes to be fun. Their music, their funny staff meetings, you know. And of course there's problems, but I wanted it to be fun and not preachy in any way.
And try to be as lighthearted as possible, in other words. Yes.
Yeah. And not preachy. I am a Christian, but I don't like Christian fiction that preaches to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the quickest way to get me to close a Christian book. So I didn't want my book to be that way.
So one of the strengths of the book, I thought, speaking of sort of lightheartedness, was the banter between the pastor, the male pastor, and his male friends, which I thought was really wonderful, that you sort of nailed that sort of dialogue between the three of them. They clearly all had faith, but they were able to joke among each other. And I thought that was really wonderful. And there is a scene, one of the major scenes of the church, of the book has to do with Susan. Talk about Susan for a moment or two.
Okay. Well, poor Susan. I did spend a lot of time in churches. I used to sing in choirs, and my best friend at one of the churches I attended was the music director, and the girls were always after him. He was single. He was 30-ish. He was handsome. He was incredibly talented. He should have been producing shows on Broadway. And the girls were always after him, and I know how frustrating that was for him. So Susan came out of that because I wanted to show that. And also there was somebody in California named Susan who had hurt me very much. So I wanted to make her a bad character.
Hey, that's what authors can do, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
But that's why she's there. And there had to be some conflict. Michael's part of the story couldn't just be smooth sailing, right? There has to be conflict. And I have no patience with romance novels where the main couple has conflict among themselves and don't communicate and don't resolve things. So I needed the conflict to be outside of the couple.
And there's a spectacular scene, where it becomes as close to preachy as it gets, the book does, where, Susan, is sort of brought down a few pegs, shall we say.
Yes.
Which is a wonderful scene in the book. Wonderful scene. I want to talk about, there is a major court hearing at the end of the book. And I want to know what research you did to make sure that court scene was as accurate as possible. What might happen in a court situation like that?
It was a little bit of, I talked to blind parents. I'd read articles about how blind parents had sued to get their children back and things that they had done. I also didn't want to make it a big scene. I didn't want to make it super formal legal because of the fact that it's not a legal fiction book. So it had to be there, but I also it might be a little more laid back than you might find in a real family court situation. But I did my research by talking to parents who are blind and things that they do. And I'd read some articles about blind parents, how they had fought this in court.
One of the things I was curious about is there is a scene where the judge has both parents come in separately in chambers so she can see how they react to the child. And I don't know, does that happen? I was curious. Do you know if that really happens? Is that one of the things that goes on in family courts?
I do know somebody that happened to.
Okay. No, I just never heard of that before. And it's an interesting way for a judge to assess. It never occurred to me. It strikes me as a very smart way of doing business.
Yeah, I knew somebody that had that experience, and I liked that, so I wanted to show that.
Just for the record, Sherry, for those who are unaware and haven't read your book, does the father sue for custody, or is it something that the judicial system takes upon themselves because she is a blind parent?
The father does it. The father... It's kind of implied some shenanigans going on behind the scenes with the father, and the father's family are very wealthy and powerful. So it's implied that there might have been some behavior behind the scenes to try to get the judge to go their way. Basically, the father does it out of spite. He doesn't really want to raise the child on his own.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds as if the Elizabeth and the, was it Nico? I think that the guy's name.
Yeah, Nico.
Nico is not an abusive relationship. She's in an abusive relationship with him, and he's very spiteful. That's where, you know, part of this revenge theme comes from. There's lots of revenge sort of not in the open of the book, but I think revenge is a rather important theme in the book. Let me say a little more about it. When I read the prologue, I thought, wow, this is going to be, there's going to be revenge involved in this book. And then when I read the rest of the book, I thought, wait a minute, it's more redemption than revenge. And then I thought, well, but there's still revenge involved, but not as much as I thought there was going to be based on the prologue. How do you react to that?
I had never thought of the revenge theme until I read what was written in the email about this interview, and I thought, you know, there is that level. You know, Nico is being spiteful and he's getting revenge on Elizabeth, or trying to.
Yep.
And Susan is trying to do that with Michael and Elizabeth. I'm doing it by certain characters that I put in the story to make people that hurt me very badly into my villains. And Elizabeth tries, I don't want to give away the story. Elizabeth tries to do it to Nico to get her child back. It's not revenge in the sense of you're reading a thriller and somebody's going out killing all the bad guys. It's not that kind of revenge, but it certainly is emotional type of revenge.
It's much more subtle. Than typical, yeah, I think that's right. You know, there's a lot of vengefulness in the book, but you know, when I originally wrote the revenge part, I just read the prologue, and I thought, wow, okay, this is going to be a major theme of the book. And then I read the rest of the book, and I thought, wait a minute, that isn't fair. I regret writing that. And then I thought about it some more and said, no, wait a minute, it's a minor theme, but it's an important theme. And I'm not a romance. I don't read lots of romance novels. Maybe you have more than I have, but is sort of vengefulness a major theme in a lot of these books?
Not really.
Not really. Okay.
Sometimes it depends on the type of romance novel. Sometimes you have the other woman plot line that seeks to get on revenge on the new love. And I frankly don't like reading that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So that's why I made Susan's part really, it's there, it's important, but it gets dealt with quickly. It's not something that drives a wedge between Michael and Elizabeth.
even though it could have, obviously.
It could have, yes.
Could have, yeah. And then
And Elizabeth are adults. And mm-hmm. so they actually do some strange thing called communicate.
details, right?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then it occurred to me, one of the thought about this repentance revenge thing is that, you know, in some ways repentance, makes it harder to do revenge. You know, repentance is the whole idea of forgiveness, right?
Yes.
So it's sort of the reverse in some ways, you know.
Cause Nico never repents for what he did.
No, never.
And Susan never repents for what she did.
No, Susan ends up, as I understand it, another church doing the same thing she was doing at the church.
A lot of times young women, and I don't know how true this is anymore, but in my experience, so let me clarify, this is my experience. A lot of times young women, especially if they've grown up in the church, they have an ideal of marrying a pastor. That's a lofty goal. There's nothing wrong with that. But I just wanted to, you know, show that. And so that's kind of why Susan is the way she is, because this is the dream that she grew up with, that she would marry a pastor.
It's interesting. It's an interesting dream. I also think it's like those people who want to marry someone in power, whether it be a male or a female, they don't know, the downsides of that.
Yeah.
You know, being a pastor is hard work.
It is very hard work.
And
very
dedicated.
24/7.
Yes.
Yeah. Or being a business executive, or being executive of a large nonprofit.
Our doctor,
you know, all those things are really stressful things. And I think sometimes we sort of forget that. And if you're going to be in a romantic relationship, also law enforcement people,
they're human beings as well.
That's right. And they're under enormous stress.
Yeah.
And a lot of times under enormous stress. And we civilians need to remember that, especially if we're going to get engaged with somebody like that, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah. So talk a little bit about Michael and, the heroine's, I'm drawing a blank on right now, the name. What's the name of the heroine?
Elizabeth.
Well, thank you. About Michael and Elizabeth's relationship, especially how Michael sort of clues into the blindness piece.
Yes, there's a scene where they first meet early on in the book. It's one of my favorite scenes where her sister had oriented her to her neighborhood, and there was a church nearby, and she's walking outside on a snowy evening, and she comes to the church and she just goes in, and she's sitting there and she's crying and she's saying, I don't believe you. I don't believe you exist, God, but if you do, why am I going through this? What am I going to do? That whole sort of thing we do when we're very upset. And Michael comes to the church to get his notes to work on his sermon, and he hears her, and that's how they first meet. And she has a guide dog, so her dog is laying on the floor with its harness on. So he sees that and recognizes it. And I let Elizabeth give him little clues on how to direct her or guide her. And I kind of educate the reader by the way I do this with Michael and the people in his life as they meet Elizabeth. I didn't want a book like what I used to call How I Live Life as a Blind Person. I wanted a book where the main character is blind, but that's just part of who she is.
Exactly.
And the way you know she's blind, she has a guide dog, she reads Braille, she uses a screen reader.
We're people who happen to be blind. Blindness
exactly.
is part of us, but we do have to live our lives, and I'm glad that you summarized that also.
Yeah, so that's what I wanted. So the stuff about Elizabeth's blindness isn't bludgeoning the reader. Look, she's blind. Look at how she does this. It's just part of who she is, and it's no more important than anything else about her.
When you were laying out Michael's character, I know you don't include everything you write in the book, you know, but when you were writing about Michael and figuring out who he was, did you have anything about him having interactions with people who were different than him or people with disabilities or some way? Cause he seemed to be able to take the whole thing in stride, which is, in my experience, a bit unusual for your average, as I call them, light dependent person. You know, he seemed to take everything in stride. When you were thinking about him, did you have a vision of him having that prior history of some kind?
In my mind, I thought he'd been around disabled people before, but also my dear friend that was a music minister that I mentioned was like that when we first met. There was just no big deal about me being blind.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of, and by the way, my friend was not anything like Michael. He's more like Michael's music minister, Terry. That's my friend's name is Terry. But I just thought Michael would be very relaxed with it. And he's been exposed to people who are different in some way before.
And I think that's really the key. I don't think and thinking about my relations with people, you know, who are non-disabled, there are people who just are able to handle it without any difficulty at all. And when you talk to them after a while, it's more often a comment that they were in Europe for a while and met with people who were different or some other country, or they were, had friends who were different than they were growing up. It wasn't so much a matter of them being around people with disabilities. It was a matter of them being around people who were different and learning how to adjust accordingly, developing skills, that they could then, use if, as it were, as skills and soul that they could use, you know, when they met somebody else who was different, who happened to be blind.
Yeah. I grew up, I'm the oldest of five, I think. And I grew up, my parents didn't treat me any differently than they treated my siblings, except that I was oldest. I had more responsibilities to do. But so my siblings have always accepted me just the way I am, and there's never been a big deal. And I sometimes hear blind friends talk about how their families don't accept them and don't like them and feel they got cheated when they were kids because the blind kid got too much attention. And I never had that. So I just come into relationships expecting people to accept me, even though I know that some won't.
Yeah, I think that's right. Who do you hope will read this book?
I hope that everybody will read it, but realistically, I hope that people who like romance will read it. I think it's got a good romance, even though it's not heavy romance. There's not one sex scene in it. I also think people who want to read about characters who are different, I'd like them to read it, you know, different from the norm in a novel. And people who are, you know, interested in small town stories, even the people who like religious fiction.
Before we get into the participation part of our show, could you tell us where we can find your book?
Yes, you can find it on Amazon and Kindle and paperback. You can find it on Bard, and you can find it on audible.com. It is not available on Bookshare yet. I had some problems with their release form, some accessibility issues with the PDF file. So I just have to get back to them on that and see if we can try that again.
Yeah, join the crowd. I had a similar problem with Bookshare.
I don't get along with PDF files very well either.
Yeah.
It's doable, but it's a pain.
One of those things that can't be avoided.
Yeah.
It is now time for our participants to take part in our program. You're listening to In Perspective. I'm Bob Branco. He's Peter Altschul. Our guest is Sherry Gomes, author of Haven. So Raymond, do we have any hands raised?
We do. We have about three people so far.
All right.
First up is Robert Acosta. You are up first.
Robert, yes, welcome.
Thank you. An outstanding presentation. Liza, I want to call her. Hello. Nobody called her Elizabeth. I mean, Elizabeth.
That's right. It is
her
Liza.
Friends called
right.
her Liza.
Thank you. Yeah. That's where I was confused.
But I want to point out a couple. I must tell you honestly, Lisa, when I started reading, I said, oh, romance. Well, it's predictable. But boy, I kept reading and I was sure happy that I did. I want to commend you because this is also, and you said it, for sighted readers who don't know about blindness. You did it in a positive way. And, you did it in a way that, wasn't, I've read books about blind guys who live their lives. It's disgusting. They get into, you know, I ate the biscuits or I did this. You were very well adjusted. You're a great person. So my question as a guide dog user, I really liked the way you, told Ethan about what a guide dog did. You told people in a mature way why you've got, you know, leave the dog alone, but then he can play at times. So I guess I don't have a question rather, and I'll be done, comments. I think it was a very fine book. I'm very proud of you. You've made great strides for blind people. Thank you. And by the way, your mother in the book turned away from you, right? Because you were disabled. Liza was disabled, as I remember correctly.
Oh, the mother, yes.
Yes.
Which did happen
thank
to
you.
Me.
I know you're saying, well, where's this question? I'm a fan.
That's great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And just for the record, who's Ethan?
Ethan is Michael's little boy.
And how old is he in the book?
He's 4 in the book, like 3 to 4. Michael's wife died 3 years before the story starts in a car accident. And Ethan was about 6 months old at that time.
One of the things that struck me about Ethan is that he was quite a talker and said some amazingly smart things for a 3-year-old.
I'll tell you about that.
Please do.
My dear friends in Colorado have 4 children. I helped to raise all of them. And all their kids talked like that. Nobody ever talked baby talk to them. So when they started talking, they used real words, whole sentences. The first time I met their daughter, because I had left Colorado at the time, I hadn't seen them. The first time I met their daughter, she was 18 months old. She came downstairs. She walked up to me and said, "Where are my father and my mother?" So
how old were they? How old was that kid who said, "Where's my father and mother?"
She was 18 months old at the time.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. So that's why Ethan talks like that. He's kind of the character that represents all 4 of those kids. Really the boys, it's 3 boys and a girl, and the 3 boys were wild.
Well, and Ethan is quite a character. There's no
yes,
question
he
about
is.
That. Quite a character. Thank you, Bob.
Phone number ending in 141, you are up first.
Or next?
Up second.
Second, and we have a couple others after that.
Okay, great.
Okay, can you hear me now?
We can.
Okay.
Hey, hey Joe.
Wait a minute.
What is your question for our guest?
I'm going to suggest that we go on to somebody else.
Let's go back.
Wait a minute. Bob, I fixed it. Can you hear me now?
Yes. What is your question, Joe?
Okay. Hi, Sherry. Joe from Boston. Can you give out your contact later so we can tell you some of the things that we've been through? I'm one. And is this book fiction or nonfiction? I mean, you know what I mean?
It's totally fiction. And I'll give you my author contact information later. Just remind me, Bob.
Okay. Actually, we are not allowed to do that on these podcasts. The only thing that I can suggest, is that, people write to Bob or me and we will forward the information to you, Sherry.
Okay.
And then if you want to respond, you're welcome to. So,
Bob can, we can exchange numbers off air with Bob. Yeah. That's what we do sometimes.
Yeah.
Emails. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So if you want, send a note to Bob and, he will put you in touch with the author.
Sure. The reason I asked Sherry, did you have these experiences in life, about your marriage and all that? Or is this just something you wrote?
I didn't have these experiences. I had some of the experiences. My mother did not want to raise me because I was disabled. So my dad and my stepmother did, and they are represented by Liza's parents in the book. But I never had any children, so I never went through this custody thing. And I never married a small town pastor either.
The reason I ask, my parents never accepted me, and I'll tell you that when we correspond by email. All right. Thanks a bunch, Bob.
So, Sherry, when you said you were the oldest of five siblings.
Hold on for 2 seconds. Joe, could you mute yourself, please?
Yeah, please. Yeah, there's too much background noise. Yeah. Sherry, when you stated that you were the oldest of five siblings, was that through your stepmother and father? Were they their children?
Three of us, me and my first two brothers are from my dad and my biological mother. And then the other two are from my dad and his second wife.
Okay.
But Raymond? I love them like they're my full. I don't ever think of them as half anything.
Of course.
Yeah.
Sure. Phone number ending in 089, you're up next, and then we have Deanna after that.
Okay, phone number ending in 089, you are next.
Hi, it's Joni.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thank you, Bob. And Sherry, I want to tell you that I have been reading about Hayden. I'm hearing something.
That's right, go ahead, just go ahead.
I keep reading about you and your book on DB Review, and I haven't read it yet, but I'm planning to. One of the things that makes me very happy is that you've taken into account that not everybody is a Christian, and I am not. I happen to be Jewish. And I don't care to read Christian fiction, but your book sounds like it's something that I will really, really enjoy. And you've been getting terrific reviews on DB Review, and everybody loves your book. So I can't wait to read it, and I will read it very soon. And I'm glad that it's on Bard. So thank you. The book sounds absolutely great. And hearing this interview has made me really want to read it right now. So thank you, Sherry.
Thank you, Joni. I hope you enjoy it. And I promise you it's not preachy. I'm not trying to shove anything in anybody's face.
It's absolutely true. It's not. It's not preachy at all.
Thank you so much, Sherry. Yeah.
Thanks, Joni.
Deanna is next.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I think that your book is the right book for this time, because people need light reading, and they need a sense of security. And reading literature like yours that is softer, and there's tough times in life, and yes, it's can be overwhelming, scary, whatever. But when you do it with a light touch like this one, you give people hope, and it takes them away from all of the, there's some stuff that I just can't read right now. It depresses me. It pulls me down, and I've got enough down to deal with in my daily life at this point. So I just wanted to congratulate you on your formula of telling what could be a very sad story in a positive, hopeful vein. So thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Deanna.
Thanks, Deanna.
Ray.
There are no other questions at this time.
Interrupt us when there are, so that we know, so that they can be next. Thanks.
So I am curious, Sharon, can you talk about the relationship between Liza and Michael's mom? I thought that was really interesting. Michael's mom wasn't quite sure what to make of her, if I remember correctly, initially. Talk about that.
Yeah, she wasn't. She was concerned. She'd never really been around disabled people before. So she was concerned about it. And she had to take her time getting to know Liza and coming to care for her as she is. I felt that that was important to show because we meet people like that. We meet people who are uncomfortable around us in the beginning, but eventually come to be our friends. And so I wanted to kind of show that sort of relationship.
And I thought it was very wise about how that those interactions happen. You describe it really well, you know, where Liza is encouraged to meet, you know, one-on-one with Michael's mom, and they have a conversation, and it really works out really well after that conversation without going into great detail. But I thought that scene was really sensitively written.
I thought also that she would, Margaret is her name, I thought she'd be concerned about this person coming into Michael's and Ethan's lives, because she's been, besides Michael, she's been Ethan's primary caregiver.
Right.
Suddenly there's a strange woman. She's blind. She doesn't know her. Michael hasn't known her very long. I thought Margaret's concerns were realistic. So I really like that you thought they were handled well.
Yeah. No, I thought that was a really good scene. Where the two became friends, you know,
yeah.
They became friends. I also really sort of appreciated the support that, you know, both Michael and Liza were going through really tough times, and, they both got support from other people besides themselves.
Yeah.
And you sort of described that support really well, you know, Michael and his two, wacko friends. in ministry, and they, you know,
yeah.
you don't read that kind of stuff in traditional Christian novels that I've read, they're real people. I'm not a fan of Christian novels either for the same reason you are. And one of the reasons is that I don't have the sense a lot of these folks are real. They're not real. And your characters are real. And I really do appreciate that. I also appreciate, by the way, when the Bible does come up, and it does come up in a very significant way in one scene, the scriptures you chose to use, I thought were really interesting, you know, all about gossip and all that stuff. Which I thought were really, really kind of cool. I'm sure it was, you know, and Liza sort of, you know, getting help and getting those scriptures under her belt and using them very, very effectively, I thought was really a wonderful moment.
Gossip is a big thing I dislike. A friend of mine was very hurt by it in a church situation, which is part of why that scene is there, because it's something I wished I could have done for my friend. So Liza got to do that.
Yeah, no, it is a great scene. Yes, Ray.
I just want to give someone a chance. Marlene, you had your hand up, but then I see it's not up anymore. I don't know if there's a question you had that maybe you felt we might have missed, but just to give you a chance if you did have a question.
We'd love to hear from you, Marlene, if you want to say something or ask a question.
Okay. Well, I don't have a question. I've read Haven actually a couple times now. I have the book. I really love it. I am a born again Christian, and I do not believe in the preachy stuff either, but I hope to think that, my books, my characters are realistic. But anyway, I'd like you to speak a little bit about the fact that you are writing a second book.
Yes, I am writing a second book. It's a sequel in the sense that it's the next book in the series, but the main characters will be different. It does take place in Haven Valley, and we will see Michael, Elizabeth, and kids. They'll make occasional cameos. A lot of the action takes place in a coffee shop called the Bookshelf Cafe. And the characters are older. They're in their late 50s or early 60s. That happened because I realized as a romance writer, I should read romances, and I didn't like a lot of romances I was reading. And I sat down and thought about it and realized it's because a lot of romance novels are written about young people. And that's great, but I've already been there. I've been in love as a young person. I've had my heart broken. I've recovered. I've had my first job. I've, you know, been through all of that.
Do you think that that's the market? Because that's a good question. The younger people, I hear this a lot in business and in radio and other aspects of life. Is that the market today, or is that a mistake for me to make that assumption?
I think that's the primary market, but not as much as it used to be. There's a whole section of whole genre of romance now called seasoned romance. And it's romances with older couples. And I've read more in other types of genres where main characters are older people, because there's a lot more, you know, with the advent of self-publishing, there's a ton of opportunities for people to write books and publish them. And a lot of them are great. A lot of them maybe aren't great, but a lot of them are great. And so people of all ages and inclinations are writing. So I think that's why we're seeing more older people in books.
So when do you anticipate this book coming out?
Well, I have to finish it. I got stuck on a chapter.
Okay.
I write in what they call pantsers. I don't outline my book. I know where it starts, where it ends, and a couple things that are going to happen along the way. But at the same time, I have to write in order. So I got stuck on a chapter. I couldn't go ahead and write the next chapter and just wait. I had to finish. I had to get unstuck and write that chapter before I could move on to finish the book. So it's pretty close to being finished now.
So you think within a year you'll have your second book out?
Is that I'm hoping it'll be in the next 6 months, 4 to 6 months.
Well, when it comes out, let us know. We'll have you back.
All right.
Indeed.
Marlene, if you're still there, I'm not aware of any of your books. So if you want to, we'd love to have you on our show talking about a book or two if you are interested. So let us know.
Awesome. Absolutely. I sure will. But I hope you don't mind. I'm a Christian author, but,
doesn't matter to me.
I hope other people would want to read it, not be turned off by that. So.
Well, I've read a lot of good Christian fiction, so I didn't mean to imply that no Christian fiction was good. I've read some good things, but to tell you how I feel about Christian fiction, I hated the Left Behind series.
The Left Behind series?
Very popular 20 years ago. I came to a point where I just wished the Antichrist would get all the supposed good guys and get rid of them. Well, because they were boring and really dislikable.
My reaction to the Left Behind series, for the record, is it's really lousy science fiction.
Yeah.
I know what it was intended to do. Preposterous. I also think it's done a whole lot of destructive stuff to the Christian movement, but that's another conversation for another time.
Yeah.
But yeah, your point is well taken. I agree with you. What a concept. That's great. So Marlene, let's shoot me an email and let's talk, because I'd love to get you on.
Okay. Will do.
Okay.
Right. We have about 2 minutes left. So if anybody would like to ask a final question of Sherry, this is your opportunity to do so.
Any questions from the audience, Ray?
No.
Okay. So Sherry, my final question for you is, what would you say, to an aspiring writer, or maybe to yourself, looking back on your life, what would you say to yourself 25 years earlier to improve as a writer or to start as a writer?
Right. I tend to like gather things. I remember going with a friend of mine and her daughter. Her daughter wanted to get some clams off the beach in Washington State. And then she felt guilty about it, so she wanted to take the clams back. And I wrote about that and called it the Great Clam Caper, just in case that would ever show up in a book. Also, try writing fan fiction, because fan fiction gives you the chance to have total strangers read your work. My friends and my family are predisposed to like what I write. So having total strangers read what you write and review it really let you know how the general public might take your work if you want to write to appeal to the general public, which I do. But whatever you do, write. If you want to be an author, you got to write.
And one final question. Do you have a website?
Yes, sherrygomes.com.
So let's spell that
Sherry,
out.
Sherry, is that SHERRYGOMES.com, correct?
Yes.
For those people who need the spelling.
All right.
Yeah. Sherry, it was a real pleasure having you on the program today. Thanks for taking the time. And good luck with your second book, let alone your first.
Thank you very much.
And I hope your book share problems can be resolved.
Yeah, me too.
You know?
Definitely.
Thank you again.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Next week, we're going to have on our show another American Council of the Blind scholarship winner. We had one on in March. We have another one coming on in June. Her name is Chantel Zuzzi. I hope I'm pronouncing that name correctly. We're going to find out a lot about her next week on In Perspective. I want to thank our participants. I want to thank Raymond and Peter, of course, for being with us today. Go safe with God's abundant blessings. I'm Bob Branco. Have a great week, everybody.
And condolences to the Boston Celtics.